This BBC podcast is supported by ads outside the UK.
Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com. Als Gründerinnen und Gründer willst du vor allem eins, schnell vorankommen. Egal ob beim Product Market Fit, deinem nächsten Schritt oder deinem ersten großen Enterprise Deal. Doch mit KI, die Entwicklung immer schneller macht, steigen auch die Anforderungen an Sicherheit. Und das früher als je zuvor. Wer Themen wie Security und Compliance richtig angeht, ermöglicht Wachstum. Wer zu lange wartet, bremst es aus. Deshalb setzen viele Startups früh auf Wanta und wachsen sicher weiter. Wanta macht es einfach mit tiefen Integrationen, starker Automatisierung und kontinuierlichem Monitoring, das mithält. Und wenn es ans Audit geht, seien Wochen bereit, nicht erst in Monaten. Jetzt starten auf wanta.com.
BBC Sounds. Music, Radio, Podcasts.
Welcome to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. We're in a room where you, me and the top experts come together to understand the great issues of the day, inside 28 minutes. In this edition, the Chinese are cracking down in Hong Kong. Is the one country, two systems dream over? Since the beginning of the year, most Hong Kong residents have been able to apply for a new visa, allowing them to come to Britain and eventually to settle. The move was made in the face of growing evidence that China was intent on major changes in the freedoms enjoyed by the city. Since then, that grip has tightened, and last week a new immigration bill was passed, which some fear will allow the authorities to bar people from entering or leaving the city. Are we witnessing, as many fear, the end of Hong Kong as we've known it? And is there anything anyone can do? Step into the briefing room and together we'll find out. First, a little bit of necessary history from the briefing room's John Murphy.
Let's begin back in 1842 and the Treaty of Nanking, which ended the first Opium War between China's Qing Dynasty and Imperial Britain. Hugh Davis is a former British diplomat who served as ambassador negotiating the 1997 return of Hong Kong to China. He now advises businesses wanting to invest in China.
Part of the deal was that a treaty was signed between Britain and China under which the island of Hong Kong and a little bit of the peninsula opposite became British territory in perpetuity. The difficulty later was this was too small, and therefore more land was required a bit later, but the Chinese would not agree to letting us have it in perpetuity. So in 1898, the rest of the land, the new territories, were simply leased to Britain for 99 years. That lease was therefore due to expire in 1997.
After Japan's defeat in World War II, Britain regained control of Hong Kong. And on the mainland, the Chinese Communist Party was in charge. Millions of refugees fled to Hong Kong. In the meantime, the British were implementing their legal system in the colony.
By the time, shall we say, the 1960s, 70s, 80s, Hong Kong had become established as one of the principal trading entrepôts in the whole of the world. And Hong Kong became also a massive financial centre.
But the clock was ticking, and the people of Hong Kong were getting nervous about China's future plans for the territory. In 1982, official talks began between China and Britain to negotiate what might happen when the 99-year lease expired.
The two sides agreed to establish the outline of a treaty, which became known as the Joint Declaration. Deng Xiaoping had come up with this unusual formula of one country, two systems, under which he agreed that Hong Kong could continue under Chinese sovereignty after 1997, but would be allowed to operate under different social and economic systems.
In 1984, Margaret Thatcher signed the Joint Declaration with the Chinese, who then drew up a mini-constitution known as the Basic Law, to ensure the continuity of most of the laws in Hong Kong. That was supposed to be valid for 50 years after the official handover on July the 1st, 1997.
Ladies and gentlemen, His Royal Highness, the Prince of Wales.
5 hours from now, the Union flag will be lowered and the flag of China will fly over Hong Kong. More than a century and a half of British administration will come to an end.
But it didn't take long before there was trouble. In 2003, massive protests broke out over a change to the Basic Law, which introduced offences such as secession, subversion and treason. The authorities had to shelve their plans.
There were also a number of other demonstrations over the years about various things, mainly about the failure of the Beijing authorities to allow the steady accretion of democratic accountability in Hong Kong. They had given a promise that there would be elections, but they didn't allow these elections to take place. So more and more people came on the streets to protest about that.
And it all came to a head in 2019.
When the current chief executive, Carrie Lam, decided to introduce a new law to allow offenders in Hong Kong to be extradited to the mainland. And no one in Hong Kong wants to face the law on the mainland of China, which is much more severe penalties.
Millions came onto the streets. As the police reacted, violence broke out. Once again, the law was withdrawn. But the Chinese authorities in Beijing weren't pleased. They said Hong Kong needed stability.
So then they changed many of their own officials looking after Hong Kong. And these people were very, very much more hardline than the people who had gone before. And then, as a result of all that, in fact, on the 1st of July 2020, they introduced their new national security laws under which swinging penalties were introduced for anyone who demonstrated in any different ways. So that is where we are now. And the people of Hong Kong are suffering under the new national security laws.
Hugh Davies ending that report by John Murphy. Let's now zip from the past to the very much present. What's happening right now in Hong Kong? I'm joined in the briefing room by Mary Hoy. She writes for the online news site Quartz. Mary Hoy, what's different in Hong Kong now compared to, say, a decade ago?
Right now, what's been most different is that we're currently living under a crackdown of the kind that we have never seen before in Hong Kong history. And the thing about the crackdown is that it's constantly happening, often in drips and drabs on a daily basis, but sometimes it comes in a huge wave. And so you just get this kind of unpredictability that warps your sense of time and normality. That's not to say that Hong Kong was a fully fledged democracy with rights and freedoms completely protected, but the pace at which those things are being dismantled is very, very different. And I would say that that's the defining feature of the current Hong Kong that we're living in.
Well, let's go through the various areas that you're talking about for whom things may have changed. First, let's talk about protest. In the last few months, what's been happening to dissidents and protesters?
We have had almost no protests at all in the past few months since the national security law came into force last summer. There's just been this rapid uptick in prosecutions of activists. And this really picked up in pace earlier this year with several dozen activists and dissidents and pro-democracy activists rounded up in late February and charged for conspiracy to commit subversion under the national security law, which is a crime that carries up to life imprisonment. This week, we've had more cases going through the courts. Prominent activists like Joshua Wong was just sentenced for another 10 months for taking part in the peaceful Tiananmen vigil last June.
Now, Hong Kong has famously had a pretty free media. What's been happening there?
Press freedom is under relentless assault in Hong Kong. It is one of the key pillars of civil society that Beijing has marked out for quote-unquote enhancement. Interpret that as you will. Just last month, an investigative reporter named Bao Choi was convicted for using a public database for her investigation into a mob attack in a suburban train station in 2019 in Hong Kong. She was really just doing very routine work of the kind that journalists often do, looking up public databases, cross-checking, trying to figure out who was on the scene and at what time. And the fact that she was convicted will now have a criminal record for doing her job as a journalist really sends a clear signal to the entire industry that they are being put on notice. In addition to that, you have Hong Kong's public broadcaster, RTHK, Radio Television Hong Kong. The government has installed a new director of broadcasting who's a career bureaucrat with no journalism experience. And he's gone through to quickly censor and pull episodes that are considered politically sensitive. They've fired journalists for being too confrontational with officials. They've actually also begun erasing archival content.
You're saying that the broadcaster are beginning to get rid of archival content that might be regarded as problematic for the Chinese government.
So what they're doing is they will begin deleting episodes that are more than a year old. And the fear is that they may do the same with tweets, with their written articles. And so people are just going through, and I myself am now going through links that I've bookmarked and putting them into the Internet Archive just so that I have a historical record of this content.
And I gather there's a proposed fake news law.
Yes. This has been talked about for months now, if not at least a year or two, but it really does seem to be picking up in pace. Of course, it's unclear who will define what fake news is, but I think once that is passed through the Legislative Council, which is the lawmaking body here in Hong Kong, once that's passed through LegCo, which has no opposition anymore, it will mean that the government has free rein to decide what the media should and shouldn't say.
And what about other areas of life, Mary? Say the schools, the arts, other places where freedom of expression is sometimes constrained by authoritarian governments?
We've had films pulled from commercial cinemas because they deal with sensitive protest-related issues. RTHK, the broadcaster again, they've had to pull a show that satirized the police. We've seen lawmakers target the M+ Museum, which is Hong Kong's art museum. Particular lawmakers said that there are works in that museum that spread hatred against China. And so the chief executive of Hong Kong, the highest official, has said that the government will be scrutinizing the works in that museum very, very closely. So we have that in the arts and culture space. And of course, schools too is another key area of contention. We have National Security Education Day earlier, I think in April. That was Hong Kong's first inaugural such day, where students as young as, for example, 6 going forward will now have to learn about the concept of national security and why following the national security law should be as easy or simple as following school rules. Really just kind of starting these kids from a really young age of thinking about national security as it's defined by China.
And what impact would you say that this is having on the lives of ordinary Hong Kongers? You can see it has a significant impact upon journalists, upon the intelligentsia, upon students and so on. But what about the rest of Hong Kong?
The repression really just touches upon all ordinary Hong Kongers, even if you're not looking to be particularly outspoken. There's been a hotline set up for civil servants to report on their colleagues or alleged violations of the national security law. The Hong Kong police has set up a national security hotline, and that's been used, according to police, some 80,000 times in the past 6 or 7 months or so. So it really does touch on all Hong Kongers. And I would say that the fact that no one really knows where any of this is going means that it's hard to tell exactly where the repression will turn to next.
Mary Hoy, why is China acting in this way now? Joining me is Yuan Chan. She used to be a journalist in Hong Kong, Beijing and Shanghai and is now a senior lecturer at City University. Yuan Chan, have you been surprised by what is happening in Hong Kong?
I can't say I'm totally surprised. We've been seeing incrementally erosions of the rights and freedoms that Hong Kong people have enjoyed and had been promised that they would continue to enjoy for 50 years after the handover. What has been surprising is the speed and the ferocity with which it's been pursued.
Now, the one country, two systems model was supposed to last until 2047. And my recollection of it was that a lot of people in the West rather hoped that the process would work like this, that the freedoms in Hong Kong would gradually permeate out to China. And actually, what you've got is the exact reverse. Do you think that that actually, looking back, it was inevitable?
For Hong Kong people, that was the best case scenario that they were hoping for. Looking back on it, you might say it was wishful thinking, but really they didn't have much of a choice considering it was an agreement reached between Britain and the People's Republic of China. So Hong Kong people didn't really have much input or any say into that. We have to remember that the People's Republic of China that you see today did not look like the People's Republic of China that you saw back then when these negotiations were taking place.
Do you think, looking back, that it was always the intention of China to make Hong Kong just like China, or do you think the intention changed?
I think what we can say is that One Country, Two Systems at the time was a very creative and pragmatic solution to a tricky question. And I think at the time, there was hope on both sides that it could work.
The question which the listener wants to know is whether or not China's intention seems to be to make Hong Kong pretty much exactly like the rest of China in terms of its political responses and its organisation.
There are a couple of very important documents that came out that precede the 2019 anti-extradition movement. One was in 2008, an article published in a journal by the head of research in the China Liaison Office, which is Beijing's de facto office in Hong Kong itself, made it clear that, in fact, there was a parallel team of mainland cadres in Hong Kong called a second governing team. It started floating this idea that there is no separation of powers in Hong Kong between the executive, the legislature, and the judiciary. It already rang many alarm bells because it was, you know, the independent judiciary is a cornerstone in the way that Hong Kong people and the way that the Hong Kong system functions, the way that Hong Kong people perceive of their city and the way that it's run. So that began to question that independence. And then in 2014, just before the umbrella movement, the Occupy movement broke out later in September, the State Council released a paper on the way that One Country, Two Systems actually functions in the city. And that laid out that Hong Kong wasn't a fully devolved jurisdiction and that the autonomy was something that was conferred onto it with the agreement and by the approval of the central government. And that white paper asserted that the central government had complete jurisdiction, complete governance, comprehensive jurisdiction over Hong Kong. I think from that moment, the writing was on the wall that Beijing really wanted to have more and would exercise more control over Hong Kong.
So the idea that somehow or other what's happened recently is simply a response to the democracy movement is not right. Essentially, this has been latent and going to happen pretty much all along. It was just a question of the speed with which it would happen.
I think speed and degree. So the degree is perhaps greater. The speed is definitely increased. But all along, we have been, for instance, seeing both hard and soft methods, as it were, to bring Hong Kong into the fold. So there's been something called the Greater Bay Area Development Policy to have greater integration between the cities and the what used to be, you know, known as the Pearl River Delta area. So that includes Macau and cities in Guangdong province. And that has been both economic integration, but also social and cultural, and even to a certain degree, political integration in that sense. So they have ideas for huge infrastructure projects. And so that has been a kind of more soft approach. And then now what we're seeing is the hard approach from all areas, really. It is a move towards greater integration one way or another.
How much of what we've seen in terms of the speed and direction of the development is down to Xi Jinping's vision for China?
Under Xi Jinping, I think most observers agree that, you know, what we have now is the greatest concentration of power in one man since the days of Mao. He has set out a vision of the great rejuvenation of the Chinese people. And we have certainly seen in recent years more aggressive nationalism. So those are all things that we have seen under Xi Jinping's leadership so far.
Yuen Chan, if Britain and other countries don't like what's happening in Hong Kong, is there anything they can or will do? And what does this all mean for the future of Hong Kong, which is, after all, one of the world's major financial hubs? I'm joined by Charles Parton, who spent much of his long diplomatic career focused on China, Hong Kong and Taiwan. Amongst other things, he's also been a special advisor on China for the House of Commons Foreign Affairs Committee. Charles Parton, do you think that what's happening in Hong Kong at the moment is essentially its incorporation into the authoritarian Chinese system?
Yes, that was always, I think, going to be the original aim as far as the Communist Party was concerned, that by 2047 there would be no difference between Hong Kong and any other Chinese city. But actually, when one says 2047, that was because there was the 50 years without change sort of theme that went through it. But in reality, of course, it's going to have to be earlier than that, because in Hong Kong, leases and contracts tend to be for 15 years. And so subtract that from 47 and you get to 2032. People want legal certainty when they're making investment decisions well before 2047. So I think that it was always going to happen, but it's going to happen really by sort of 2030 now. But the Communist Party has well advanced that timetable in the last few years because of what had happened in the last couple of years.
So what we've seen is a speeded up inevitability, in other words.
I think so, because when joint declaration was signed and the handover of Hong Kong came about, people had hoped, of course, that China itself would change. And so that when it came to 2047 or 2030, whenever it was, things would be far less different in terms of the gap between the communist system and the Hong Kong system. That hasn't happened. On the contrary, Xi Jinping has moved China in a very totalitarian direction, well away from the sorts of values and systems that were make up Hong Kong's success story.
The British government has been alarmed by this. Other governments have been alarmed by it. Is there anything anyone or any other country is actually able to do practically about it?
If you mean by that to change what the Chinese Communist Party is doing in Hong Kong and what it intends to do in Hong Kong, I think that there's very little that one can do. But I mean, I think we still have a duty to speak out, to try to uphold the values that have made Hong Kong a success, to point out to the Communist Party that they are actually taking a big risk with the success of Hong Kong. I think we have a moral duty, as we have done, to offer people in Hong Kong the opportunity to settle in the UK through the British National Overseas Scheme. But if you're trying to say, you know, can we halt what the Communist Party is doing in Hong Kong in any way, only through persuasion, certainly not through any pressure.
Do you think Hong Kong's status as a major commercial and business hub is going to be significantly affected by this integration?
I think one of the important things about Hong Kong has been its ability to reinvent itself in the last 50 years, you know, whether it started as a manufacturing base, gateway to China, then became gateway to China's investment, a financial center itself. And the conditions that allowed it to reinvent itself and become so nimble and successful, it's all a matter of intangible things like the rule of law, a good education, a free education, the free flow of information, a superb and actually very independent civil service, and to some extent, stable and benevolent politics. Okay, it was a colonial system, but it was backed by democracy rather than a Leninist totalitarian system as it is now. Now, all that adds up to an immense amount of trust and confidence in Hong Kong. And the question is whether that trust will exist or does exist in the Chinese Communist Party and its handling of Hong Kong. And I don't think it does. And that is, I think, for me, a major reason why I'm pessimistic about the future of Hong Kong and why I see a slow diminution in its importance.
Let's look at the British government's offer to some residents in Hong Kong. Do you think many people will take the opportunity of coming to Britain, maybe going to other countries as well, but coming to Britain as a result of this offer?
That, again, depends on what happens in Hong Kong and how the Chinese Communist Party treats Hong Kong. But I think that the way things are going, it is highly likely that a lot of people will come to Britain, possibly, you know, sending their children or getting their young out, because I think it's the young in particular that are perhaps lacking confidence in Hong Kong's future. So I would expect quite a number of people to come, but it does depend on how the Communist Party treats Hong Kong in the next few years.
How do you think what's happening to Hong Kong will affect the rest of us and the rest of that region?
One has to start with people. We've talked about the possibility of talented people emigrating. It's usually the people who are talented that go. And that, of course, will add to the talent pool in our country or elsewhere. When it comes to business, I think business always is fairly hard-headed about looking at the risk-profit equation. So for that reason, I don't think we should be too doomsday-ish about it. But I think there will be a slow movement elsewhere, and that will affect the region and will affect us. And if you're looking at the region, of course, what happens in Hong Kong is very closely watched by the Taiwanese. I think it's come to a stage actually in Taiwan that very few Taiwanese indeed would like to see any unification with the mainland. But what happens in Hong Kong for sure underlines that.
People have talked about the development of a new Cold War with China. Do you think the future of Hong Kong plays into that in any significant way, or is a side issue?
Well, I think that I don't like the expression Cold War. It's wrong for many reasons. China isn't Russia. We have to deal with China both economically, scientifically, technologically, geopolitically, etc. But I do think there is a values war. I can't really say what the best expression is, but values war is probably the best one that you can come up with. And it's most clearly demonstrated, if you might want to say, that the front line is in Hong Kong. I mean, you look at the judicial values, the law, we have the common law system, as does Hong Kong. China has a very different legal system under which it openly declares that the party, the Communist Party, is in control of the law, in a sense is above the law. That's a massive conflict of values, but there are also conflicts in terms of education, freedom of association to protest, and all the other things. So it underlines very clearly the enormous differences of system, whether that's political system, economic system, and value system that exists between the liberal democracies and the Leninist-style system that Beijing pursues. And that's something that this generation is going to have to get its mind around, that there is divergence. So we've got to work with that, minimise it to a large extent because we're so intertwined now in this global world, but not ignore it.
Charles Parton there with a pretty gloomy prognosis. My thanks to him, Hugh Davis, Mary Hoy and Ewan Chan. We'll be back at the same time in 2 weeks. Until then, goodbye. You've been listening to The Briefing Room with me, David Aronovich. The producers were John Murphy, Kirstine Knight and Sally Abrahams. The sound was mixed by James Beard and the editor is Jasper Corbett. And if you enjoyed this podcast, you might like other editions of The Briefing Room, which are all available on BBC Sounds. We tackle a wide range of subjects. We've recently looked at the root causes of the COVID crisis in India and at what impact Brexit is having on business. We've also explored Vladimir Putin's battle with Alexander Navalny, and there was the episode in which we asked if we were moving fast enough to tackle the climate crisis.
Hi, I'm Glenn Patterson, and I'm here to tell you about my new Radio 4 podcast, The Northern Bank Job. It was the biggest bank robbery in British and Irish history, and one of the most daring, carried out in the middle of a busy city centre at one of the busiest times of the year. With missing millions, burning banknotes and precision planning, it has all the elements of a Hollywood heist movie, but this actually happened, and its consequences could not have been more far-reaching. I'll be telling the story of the robbery through the words of the people who were caught up in it and those who dealt with its chaotic aftermath. Just subscribe to The Northern Bank Job on BBC Sounds.
Ich bin Charissa und meine Empfehlung an alle Entrepreneure, startet mit Shopify erfolgreich durch. Ich verwende Shopify schon seit dem ersten Tag und die Plattform macht mir nie Probleme. Ich habe viele Probleme, aber die Plattform ist nie eins davon. Ich habe das Gefühl, dass Shopify ihre Plattform kontinuierlich optimiert. Alles ist super einfach, integrier und verlinkbar. Und die Zeit und das Geld, das ich dadurch spare, kann ich anderweitig investieren. Vor allem in Wachstum.
Jetzt kostenlos testen auf shopify.de.